Welcome to KUOW Speakers Forum. I'm your host, John O'Brien. In this podcast episode, the idea of a post-racial society has tempted and perplexed Americans at least since Martin Luther King Jr. shared his dream. But the reality of racial bias, violence, and injustice in America still manages to dash that dream day after day. Again and again, we face the question, what kind of reckoning with our history of racism and present-day culture has to take place to move us forward? UW Professor Megan Ming Francis is looking for answers to that question. While she dismisses easy answers, she points to lessons from history and protest movements to light a way forward, and makes clear that we are all part of the problem and potential solutions.
The problem of racial inequality is not that we have a few racist apples. I think this is a misdiagnosis. The problem, I think, is that the whole tree is infected.
Megan Ming Francis is an assistant professor of political science at the University of Washington and the author of Civil Rights and the Making of the Modern American State. She spoke at UW's Kane Hall on October 12, 2016. Thanks to Sonia Harris for our recording. We're presenting the core of her talk here. You'll find the full version, including the Q&A, on our website, kuow.org/speakersforum.
Who here has, like, read, engaged with Where's Waldo books? All right, that's a lot. Okay, so for those who don't know or who've never read Where's Waldo books, what it is there's these kind of hundreds of illustrations of people engaged in various activities. The goal of the reader is to find Waldo, right? And so Waldo is a man, and he has a red and a white striped shirt, kind of looks like a candy cane. And you have to find him because he's somewhere in the mix. It's not always readily apparent, you know, but when you eventually find him, you realize that he's hanging out, he's chilling, having a good time. He's hiding at some level in plain sight. As long as you know to look for him, he's always there. I know you guys are like not paying attention to me anymore right now. Yeah, right. All right, it's okay. All right, there he is. You guys are like, I know, right? I know, it's good, okay. All right, the reason why I'm using Waldo as a way to enter into, I think, a very difficult topic is that many of the conversations I've had with well-meaning white people around the current state of racist violence has often made me feel like I'm in the most difficult Where's Waldo book. And what I mean by this, and it feels like everyone else ignores Waldo and pays attention to everything else around. So for example, a conversation that I've had far too many times over the past 3 years, after every highly publicized police shooting, go something like this, and it can happen over dinner, lunch. Normally, people call me on the phone, hey, Megan, right? I'm so stressed out about watching the news. Can you believe the way the police killed, right? Enter somebody's name, right? Alton Sterling, Philando Castile, Freddie Gray. And I pretty much always mutter something like, yeah, streets is crazy, right? Like, but what I always want to say, and kind of what I want to scream, is of course I can believe it. For me not to believe it would mean that there would have been a long period in American history in which black people were not being murdered by law enforcement officers, right? For me to believe it would mean that I would have to believe that the violent killings of black people that are now on my TV and that have invaded my social media are not the norm, that these things are aberrational, and that they're not a defining feature of American politics. But there has never been a long period in which black bodies have been safe. So why are we surprised now? All right. We have a documented history in this country of state violence against black citizens, from slavery to Reconstruction to lynching to Jim Crow to civil rights to post-civil rights era to Hurricane Katrina. And yes, absolutely, Hurricane Katrina gets its own special call out because it was this crazy moment, right, in American politics in which we actually like watched at some level, right, the state abandon and leave black people to die on national television. To now. It's always, racial violence has always been a part of the larger mural of American society. I don't remember growing up, even in as wonderful as a liberal place as Seattle in the 1980s. That's crazy, right? I know some of my students are like, what? But I don't remember even growing up here with black people who were raised to feel always safe. Most black people that I know have been constantly aware of the fragility of black life, especially when it comes to interactions with law enforcement. However, most people, maybe not the people in this room, maybe, but many people have chosen not to see what has been hiding in plain sight for a very, very long time. People across this nation have paid more attention to the violence today. Of course, we know that because social media has amplified the violence and made it much more visible to us. But just because we didn't have Facebook live streams and body cameras before does not mean that African Americans have not faced high, high levels of racial violence. So today I want to focus on this violence against black bodies because I think that this is an area that we choose not to see because it doesn't easily collapse with our lofty visions of how we believe American democracy should operate. I want to suggest that the silence around the long history of violence and race in this country is a complicated story of well-intentioned individuals who are nevertheless responsible for the contemporary racial crisis. It's important to understand that we do not get to a world in which racial violence is no longer an issue by ignoring the power and persistence of racial violence throughout the long arc of history. So what do we see when we actually pay attention to black suffering? According to the most recent statistics, unarmed blacks are 3 times more likely to be killed by police than whites. The question on everyone's mind and the question that I get asked the most is, how do we fix this problem? And I confess I cringe at this question, not because it's not a good question, but because I think we're asking the wrong question. I'm not convinced we even understand how we got to this point in the first place. Better understanding of the root causes, I think, will help us to figure out how we get out of it. I admit that I sometimes, oftentimes perhaps, am more eager to solve a problem than I am to understand it. A few years ago, I adopted, some of you guys know this because there are some people who I know up in here, I adopted a corgi and I named him President Bartlett. See, the people who just laugh, they gave away their age, right? Because my students, whenever I, President Bartlett is the president on the West Wing, he's my favorite president. And now when I show clips of the West Wing in my classes, they're like, ooh, our parents used to watch that. And I'm like, oh, okay. So President Bartlett, my corgi, is cute, is adorable, but he had been, look, what? I know, isn't that amazing? Okay. But he had been abused and was very aggressive to other dogs. He would just go crazy at the sight of any dog that he saw. For the first year, my fix was to walk him at odd hours of the day. So I would straight up wake up at 3, 4 a.m. in the morning and walk this little dog. Just in hopes that, like, right, because rational thinking individuals do not walk their dog at 4 in the morning. Right? Okay. This, of course, worked only marginally well, and I was stressed. The next year, I realized that I needed a better long-term solution and decided to work with the trainer to figure out the root causes or the reasons behind his reactive behavior. On the first day of working with us, the trainer told me point blank, and I'll never forget this because it stuck with me, fixes that do not address the root causes of the problem are not really fixes at all. It was at this moment that I realized that in my rush to solve President Bartlett, I had actually made him worse. The contemporary crisis, I think, surrounding the killing of unarmed blacks suffers, I think, from a lack of understanding of the root causes. Better understanding the reasons behind why we are in the present state, I think, will help to shed light on what is needed to transform our society and move it forwards. All right, so why does police killing of unarmed blacks keep happening? Right, this is also the kind of the other big question here. I think it keeps happening because we have the wrong diagnosis and the wrong cure. What I mean by this is that we think the problem is that there are a few stubborn racist, and that we think the cure, not all of us, but some of us, think the cure to most racial injustices is education. In the rest of my talk today, I'm going to challenge these ideas and suggest a new way to understand the problem as well as the solution. First, part of the reason a police killing of unarmed blacks keep happening is because we have not properly wrestled with the long history of racial terror in this country, which has treated blackness as a substitute for criminality. Instead, what we like to do when we're confronted with the jarring racial injustices is to point to the bad racist apples, right? Like, this is, okay, cool. We like to individualize the problem and situate it away from us. This is why we're able to make sense of individuals like Dylann Roof, right? The young man from Charleston, South Carolina, who had a white power manifesto. However, the problem of racial inequality is not that we have a few racist apples. I think this is a misdiagnosis. The problem, I think, is that the whole tree is infected. The problem is that the presumption of dangerousness is tightly bound to race for so many in this country. For police officers to justify the use of deadly force, they have to reasonably believe that their lives are in danger. In all of the high-profile cases of police killings of unarmed blacks over the past year, officers attest to feeling under threat. But what does this mean in the context of unarmed citizens? It means that black skin triggers a heightened sense of threat, a life-threatening sense of threat for some people. And this perception of danger influences the decision to use deadly force. If all of the unarmed people shot and killed by police for the year 2015, 36% of them were black men, even though black men make up right now 6% of this nation's population. But it's not just police officers, and I want to be very clear about this, right? It's not just police officers that prop up this myth of black danger. The myth is reinforced and takes on a truth-like quality through everyday interactions. When a black man passes and a woman clutches her purse, or when a group of black teenagers pass a car and they hear the jarring sound of someone who has just pushed their automatic locks because they are afraid, right? And I've been with friends on both sides of this, black men after a long day at work, mostly in New York, who just want to go home and not be seen as a threat when they, as they leave. I've also been with white and Asian women friends who clutch their purse and walk quickly when they see a black man on a dimly lit street and then feel ashamed and a need to over-explain their actions to me. A few times I've also been on the receiving end of having who I was reduced to someone else's false perception of how much of a danger I posed. A few years ago, I was coming back from a trip and was singled out by a TSA agent. I thought I had left a water bottle in my bag, as I so often do, but he ushered me to the side and two other TSA agents surrounded me. And my gut told me that this was not a good thing. The officer in charge started a series of questions, accusing me of bringing a weapon into the airport. When I insisted that I did not bring a weapon into the airport, he triumphantly produced a piece of costume jewelry, a double ring that I had picked up while I was on vacation for $4. It was his gotcha moment, and it was my very confused moment. It was at this point where he accused me of bringing brass knuckles, a deadly weapon, into the United States airport. I was almost at a loss of words, which my students know is rare for me. So I politely pointed out that this ring was plastic, it was not brass, and these were not knuckles. It was a costume jewelry ring. But have you ever talked to someone and felt like you didn't exist, like they saw right through you when they spoke to you? Well, that's how I felt. He grew more angry at my explanation and told me, "You people always lie. I know that this is a weapon, and we're not going to let someone dangerous like you board a plane today." Well, at this moment, I started to get scared and started to shake, right? Because we've all seen this movie, and it never really ends well for the black person who walks into an airport with a weapon, right? It doesn't. It's horrible. So I had to do what I hate doing, and which I pretty much never do. I had to use my credentials to get me out of a very, very bad situation. I informed him, finally, that I was a professor who taught courses surrounding American politics and constitutional law, and that he could not legally detain me, right? And then he got nervous, because he still was like, it's weird, it's right, like me in sweats and a hoodie, and looking younger, and it just like doesn't score with our perceptions of who should be professors and who should not, right? Okay. So then he got nervous, and he asked what university I worked at, as if that would be like his, like, I knew she was lying. So I told him, and on his TSA iPad, he Googled my name, and then the blood drained from his face as he realized I was indeed a college professor. I wasn't making any of this up, and I probably knew my rights really well. And then when he looked back at me, he finally saw me, not as a dangerous threat, but as a person deserving of rights. After a few more minutes, he finally let me go to catch my very delayed flight. I was still trembling with rage at the way that I had been treated. I finally found a seat in the airport terminal, and I felt a tap on my shoulder. A woman airport worker said that he always does this to black passengers, and that I was lucky to have been released from his custody so quickly. Wow. But it shouldn't take a university website profile to be viewed as non-threatening. That's far too high, and that's a ridiculous bar. I share this story because in talking about the present racial crisis, we tend to focus on the police and ignore our own complicity in creating an environment in which black lives are not treated as equal. To be clear, because people always say, how do you feel about body cameras? I'm in favor of body cameras. I'm in favor of a non-militarized police force. I'm in favor of better laws that make police more accountable when they stop and frisk individuals on the street. But I'm not convinced that we would need something like body cameras if we didn't live in a society, not just a police department, in a society that treated blacks as suspicious and dangerous first and as citizens second. It's not just, right, it's not just a few bad apples in a police department or at an airport. It's all of us who, in small ways through our silences, in big ways through our actions, support this lie that somehow black folk are just more dangerous than the rest of us. So not only do I believe that we've misdiagnosed kind of the current problem right now, I think we also have the wrong solution or cure. We keep offering up education as a solution to racial injustice in the United States. It's as if, and this is something from my mom that she always used to do, it's as if education has become kind of the Robitussin of civil rights, right? When I was younger, and my mom, she still does actually, it's not even when I was younger, like still now. It was Robitussin, like, oh, you have a flu, Robitussin, cold, Robitussin, like, just doesn't do all these things, and I understood that finally, right, when I got older. But just like Robitussin is not a cure-all for all types of sicknesses, education despite us being in this wonderful university, is not a cure-all for all of America's racial sins. And yet education is still at the center of how most Americans conceive as a solution to what is going on right now. It's amazing. In terms of education, is that is the promise and the responsibility of civil rights. Our measure of how far we have come in the area of race relations is often calculated in how integrated our schools are, how many federal dollars are devoted to education, and how many exciting, innovative experiments are being funded by private foundations. But the problem of police killings of unarmed blacks in this country does not boil down to a solution of greater educational opportunities. A book is not going to stop the bullet barreling through the gun at Rekia Boyd in Chicago. And longer classroom times are not going to save Freddie Gray from being illegally stopped and then manhandled by police in Baltimore. This is what I know for sure, that in order to effectively combat persisting racial injustices, we must expand our vision of civil rights to include and prioritize the battle against racist violence. Instead of education, what if we place freedom from racial violence at the crux of what it means to achieve equal citizenship in this country? Doing so does not mean that we dislodge education. It does not denigrate the importance of education today. It means that we acknowledge the long history of institutionalized violence against black people and make this issue central to dismantling racism in this country. It means that addressing racial violence against black people is the precursor to other rights that we cherish. I know that what I'm proposing, this idea, like, all right, well, how might that look? Okay, is not an easy task, but I know that it can be done. Public policymakers and individuals increasingly talk about the Black Lives Matter movement as if this project is a new one, but it's not. I'm a political scientist and a closeted historian, and I've spent the last 10 years focused on a surprising finding. Before the NAACP focused on their historic battle against segregated education, they spent two decades in the early 20th century exposing the dangerous levels of racial violence endured by African Americans by police officers, by politicians, and by private white citizens. I chronicle this work in my first book, Civil Rights and the Making of the Modern American State. The book is trying to make a claim about how black citizens constructed civil rights and American politics in the darkest of times. Before Brown v. Board of Education, at the height of lynchings, abandoned by both national parties, and decades before the sit-ins and the heyday of the civil rights movement, how did the NAACP organize in a political environment that did not treat black people as equal citizens? In order to fight and to challenge the environment at the time, the NAACP organized mass demonstrations, lobbied Congress to pass a federal anti-lynching bill, and petitioned two different United States presidents to make a statement against lynching. And then the book culminates in this big landmark Supreme Court case decided in 1923 called Moore v. Dempsey, in which this is going to be the first time in which the Supreme Court kind of federal intervention in state criminal trials. It was a case involving 12 African-American men who were railroaded to death in Arkansas. And the Supreme Court is going to say in this case that mob-dominated trials, right, are unconstitutional. You guys are like, of course, right? But like, this was an important first step. For the NAACP at the time, Moore v. Dempsey made, at least for them, a sign that the federal government had not forgotten them. It was this massive, extraordinary, in-your-face campaign that forced America to confront lynching and mob violence against African Americans. It asked America how strong was its commitment to protecting black lives. When concern was raised at a meeting by another white board member, the NAACP's agenda was not broad enough there was concern, right, that it didn't also address other areas that we now associate with civil rights, such as education, voting, and housing, because at the time, the NAACP was very much focused on this issue of racial violence. Roy Nash, an African-American who was part of the NAACP's leadership, attempted to explain the organization's focus on racial violence. And he says here, and this is a quote, all the Negro wanted was a chance to live without a rope around his neck, end quote. It was a sobering but necessary reminder that if the protection of Black lives was not secured, everything else would mean very, very little. As a result of the NAACP's organizing in the first quarter of the 20th century, the rates of lynching and mob violence dramatically decreased. Much research in political science looks to institutions and elite actors in government to explain dramatic shifts in political and constitutional development over time. The NAACP's movement against racial violence tells a different story. It suggests, I think, that bottom-up protests can meaningfully change the actions taken by political institutions and make government more accountable to its citizens. The key takeaway from my research, and I think how it pertains to what's going on right now, is that protest is necessary to reduce racial violence. What I have up here is, this is actually a picture that's the part of the cover of my book. This is a protest, it's called the Silent Protest March. This was done down Fifth Ave in New York City in 1917. There's different groups. The men are walking in one section, the women are walking in another section, the kids are walking in another section. What they are doing is here in this protest march to protest the level of mob violence and lynchings and violence against Blacks across the country, to raise attention to this, right? To get in the streets and to make people look. I share this story about the NAACP's campaign against racial violence because I believe that our past history can light a way out of the present darkness. If we listen to what this history teaches us, then we must struggle through it. We must urgently confront the ways in which our actions and our institutions led to a discriminatory treatment of Blacks, even perhaps precisely if it's intentional. I'm persuaded that an equal society, that a just and a democratic society, means that we address this country's long legacy of racial violence and discriminatory treatment of Blacks in an honest way that does not conceal our own complicity. Today, many people across the United States are taking to streets and are demanding to be seen not as dangerous, but as people whose lives have meaning and deserve protection. Some of their groups are associated directly and some indirectly with the Black Lives Matter movement. Without these efforts, so many of these killings would have been swept under the rug, and the public would have lost interest long ago. But the fact that we're talking about it today, the fact that presidential candidates, no matter how painful that was to watch, are discussing police violence in the inner city on national television, owes to the hard work of so many. I do remember many presidential debates where, like, race doesn't even come up. So, I mean, all right. The Black Lives Matter movement has released a set of policy demands at the end of the summer. It's an ambitious and a beautiful statement about what Black freedom, what Black liberation might look like. But if I know anything about struggles in this country, I know that these courageous activists cannot go at this alone. Their message and my message to you is in part that we must pay attention to how Black people are treated. The stories of police brutality and killings of unarmed Blacks is not a story about Black people. It's a story about all of us. It's a story about racial progress and the stubborn durability of American racism. It's about if we will stop committing the mistakes of our past and confront our own responsibility and the great American lie about Black dangerousness. And finally, it's about if we have the courage to take a collective stand against persisting racial injustice. I want to end on a very brief story, a personal story, about the importance of history to understanding contemporary situation. So when I was at Princeton, Cornel West, people are familiar, maybe, hopefully. Okay, all right, cool. So Cornel West was one of my mentors when I was in graduate school there. He used to always tell his students to be penetrating in our interrogation of American history and to always ask, what truths are missing? So what that this book says this, what truths are missing? Professor West consistently railed against a tidy version of civil rights, what he termed a romanticized, sanitized, deodorized civil rights. This is I can't even invoke him, but I'm trying, okay? He wanted us to pay attention to the messiness, to the funk. That's always what he was always talking about, the funk. For it was in the funk that he believed the real truth was to be found and then wrestled with. So I'll never forget, because he was a fourth reader on my dissertation, so he didn't read every draft. When I finally completed my dissertation, I sent him a copy, and I'll never forget, I was at Princeton, and then I hear him across the quad, Sister Megan, and I'm like, all right, okay. So I go over there, and I'm like, hey, Professor West, how's it going? And he was like, I read your dissertation. He was like, you did good. You finally found the funk. So, yeah, you did, right? So then, because I really want to do this, I'm going to do this, and then we're going to end here. Okay, now we're done.
That's it for this podcast of Speakers Forum featuring UW Professor Megan Ming Francis. You can hear the full version on our website, kuow.org/speakersforum. Thanks again to Sonia Harris for our recording. Tune in again soon.